Okay, thank you everybody for coming. Right before Pesach is a rough one for many, and also for perhaps for the rabbi himself, as well as some people to come out. So we appreciate everybody who came. This is fantastic. Once again, thank you, Rabbi Gottlieb. Without further ado, here we go.
Thank you so much, Howie. Good evening, everyone. It's great to have you, the Erev Pesach faithful here. I think we thought that perhaps tonight could be like a two-for-one. You know, you sell your chametz and come to a shiur. I don't know how well that worked, but you're all here, so I'm thrilled to be here as well. So I think it's fair to say that without a doubt, Pesach is the paradigmatic expression in Yahadus of our focus on pedagogic virtuosity. The idea that teaching is the central act in Pesach, or during Pesach, and that from the very beginning in Tanakh of Vigadat al-Bincha, through the construction, the elaborate, rich construction of the Seder, the Mitzvah Leil Pesach, devised by Chazal, teaching and effective pedagogy are the predominant themes of Pesach. Baruch Hashem, the Jewish people have enjoyed the blessings of many fine pedagogues and master teachers throughout the generations. But I would argue that in terms of sheer focus and deliberation and depth of study of the very act and vocation of teaching, few in the 20th century could meet the mark of the great Mashkiach Rav Shlomo Volbi Zatzal. Perhaps to underscore this association between Rav Volbi and the pedagogy of Pesach, Providence has it that Rav Volbi's yahrzeit is actually Yud Zayin Nisan. So I'd like to both spend this evening with you studying a few key seminal texts of Rav Volbi to try and unpack why my claim that Rav Volbi is the master pedagogue of this last generation is not hyperbole, it's not fantasy, but it's grounded in the very real richness of these sources. And along the way, our learning should serve the Eloi Nishmaso. Rav Volbi became an iconic figure in the Olama Yeshivas, in the yeshiva world, known primarily for his two-volume sefer, the Alei Shur, which has become a modern classic of Musar for a developmental approach to B'nai Torah. In other words, B'nai Torah who want to achieve a certain aliyah, a certain elevation in their character, in their personality, beyond the lumdus that Brisk gave us, but a focus on the Musar legacy of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and his circle of Talmidim. Rav Volbi becomes this really unduplicable, unrepeatable transition figure between pre-World War II Musar, that was such a vital part of the yeshivas, even the Lithuanian yeshivas, the Polish yeshivas, even in some German yeshivas, and the post-World War expression of Haredi Judaism, chiefly centered in Eretz Yisrael, but really throughout the world of Torah Jewry. So while Rav Volbi is rightly considered a central figure in the yeshivish world, in the Haredi world, I actually want to recover Rav Volbi tonight for our purposes, our community, what we call the enlightened Orthodox community. If you don't like modern Orthodox, the enlightened Orthodox community, I believe, has a real stake, a real claim on the teachings and the person of Rav Volbi. Rav Volbi's focus on authenticity, on spiritual integrity, on his radical focus on honesty and his radical critique of superficiality. All of these elements in Rav Volbi's worldview, I think, fit very well within our community and really can serve as a prod to our own community's further spiritual development, further focus on the pnimios, the inwardness that many in the modern Orthodox speak about, inwardness, spirituality, but few were as articulate and as trenchant, as sharp as Rav Volbi in articulating what a really inward-looking but halachic Judaism would consist of. So let's look very quickly, we'll do a very quick overview of his biography, and then we're going to look at a few key texts in his corpus to really identify some of these key themes of authenticity, of spiritual sophistication, of the critique of spirit, of superficiality. So Shlomo, or Wilhelm, as he was called as a young man, was born in Germany in 1914 to a secular home. Rav Volbi is a great model of the Baal Tshuva. Before NCSY, before, you know, Torum, Sora, before the world of modern Kiruv, Rav Volbi was himself a Baal Tshuva. He was Mukurov. He became part of the Orthodox, of the observant community, while he was a student at the University of Berlin, the same University of Berlin that saw Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Huttner and the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Nechama Leibovitz. Rav Volbi was a slightly later contemporary. He was in the University of Berlin from 1930 to 1933. These are challenging years in Germany in the 30s. But he was a student, came in, as I said, as a secular Jew, unobservant Jew, and thanks to the efforts of the Orthodox Student Union, the VAD, and the VAD for the Orthodox Student Union in the University of Berlin stands for the Vereinigung Jüdischer Akademiker in Deutschland. Sounds great, right?
No, you don't say right.
forgive me. I don't have the authentic Deutsche pronunciation, but this was the VAD that drew Rav Volbi into Orthodoxy, into observance. After Berlin, after the University of Berlin, Rav Volbi becomes a student at the Hildesheimer Yeshiva, the famed Hildesheimer Yeshiva in Berlin. And then he travels to Switzerland, to Montreux, which would in another decade or two become the home of the Sri Deish, another great student of the Hildesheimer Rabbinic Academy in Berlin. Rav Butschko was the Rosh Yeshiva at the time that Rav Volbi was a student in Montreux. And then Rav Volbi begins his trek to the East and begins to accrue or to amass the bona fides of a traditional Lithuanian or Eastern European yeshiva bachar. Because from Butschko's yeshiva in Montreux, he travels to Mir, to the famed yeshiva of Mir in Poland, where he becomes a very close disciple of Rav Yeruchim Lvovitz, the great mashkiach of Mir, who is himself one of the primary disciples of the altar of Slobodka. He also studied with Rav Yecheskel Levenstein, who was a lesser mashkiach, an important figure. At the Mir, he meets what will be a fateful relationship in his life. He meets the son of a Swedish Jew by the name of Chaim or Hans Lehmann from Sweden. And essentially this friendship blossoms and it becomes Rav Volbi's ticket out of Eastern Europe, because as a German citizen, as a German national, Rav Volbi could not travel with the Mir Shiva as it moved eastward through Russia, making its escape finally to Shanghai and beyond. He actually could not travel because of his German nationality, but he was invited to neutral Sweden by the Lehman family, and he essentially became a tutor and a town rabbi in Stockholm. And then he went on to found a girls' school, a Orthodox Jewish girls' school in a suburb of Stockholm in Lidingö, Sweden, which is a little island in the province of Stockholm. where he then began to write pamphlets, essentially pamphlets that we would consider Kiruv pamphlets, or pamphlets that were meant as outreach in both German and Swedish, having acquired this new language. In 1946, Ravolbi moves to British Mandate Palestine, and he studies in the Lumja Yeshiva in Petah Tikva. 2 years later, with the birth of the State of Israel, he moves to a small community known as Be'er Yaakov, where he recently marries Rachel Grudzinski, who was the daughter of the martyred mashkiach of the Slobodka Yeshiva, Rav Avram Grudzinski, the author of the Toras Avram, another Talmid Muvhak of the Alter Mislobodka. And Ravolbi proceeds for the next 30 plus years to be the Rosh Yeshiva and the Mashkiach Ruchani at Be'er Yaakov. He becomes known in the Olam HaYeshivas as a great contemporary Musar master. In 1981, he retires from Be'er Yaakov, and he founds a Musar Yeshiva, specifically a Musar Yeshiva in Givat Shol, and enjoys another 30 plus years of notoriety and fame as a leading Musar figure. He has weekly Vadim and weekly Musar Shmuzes, which people, both Balabatim and students, Talmidim from the entire Israeli Orthodox community, as well as Balei Tshuva, as well as some secular professors, all see in Ravolbi this fascinating blend of traditional Lithuanian and Eastern European yeshiva wisdom and learning, especially of a Musar variety, plus the insights of a psychologically astute student of human nature. One of the books that Ravolbi is famous for is a thin little volume called Zriya Ubinyan Bechinuch, planting and building in education. This was a Hebrew reconstruction of John Dewey's 1916 work, Democracy in Education, where Ravolbi plays on Dewey's dialectic of rote learning, which was so necessary to sort of build a coherent community where you're using the same language, the same, you know, the same history, the same narratives. But as an American, Dewey was also concerned about preserving democratic individualism. And so how do you strike the balance between rote learning and the necessity of community building with preserving the individual integrity of each and every student? Ravolbi adapts this model and really rewrites the book in rabbinic idiom for a generation of yeshiva students and yeshiva parents. But he was versed in Freud and Jung and Adler and Kohlberg. So he was a unique figure in terms of his scope and breadth of learning, both steeped in traditional Western and Eastern yeshiva studies, but also a university student, someone that understood the world of academia, someone who understood the world specifically of psychology and science as specific fields that he had expertise in. Let's take a look. The final biographical piece is that while maintaining a form of anti-Zionism that was part of his German upbringing, if you'll recall, German Jewry before the Holocaust was overwhelmingly opposed to Zionism. There are complex reasons, historical and theological, but it took German Jewry the great trauma and tragedy of the Holocaust to shift to a more normative view of Zionism. But his early upbringing and his yeshiva training made him quite skeptical of the theological project of Zionism. But as a practical matter, he writes a book called Ben Sheshes La'asor, which are reflections on the time in Israeli history between the Six-Day War in 1967, and the Asor, Yom Kippur, Yom HaAsiri, the 10th day of Tishrei of 1973. And for those years, he actually travels to non-religious kibbutzim, to secular universities, giving talks, giving both Kiruv talks and talks of general chizuk and inspiration for a renewed sense of the Jewish people at post-1967. He had a belief that there would be massive return to orthodoxy, which hasn't fully been realized, but there is still, if you look at Israel today, with things like Nefesh Yehudi and large organizations devoted to Kiruv, Rav Volbe's vision of mass Kiruv, of mass return to Judaism, to return to orthodoxy, return to tradition, is not far off. So despite his early anti-Zionism and what lingered for the rest of his life, he had a deep love of all of Klal Yisrael, a deep love of people, secular, orthodox. It didn't matter to Rav Volbe. He loved Klal Yisrael. Let's take a look at a couple of passages here, because I think they're striking in their originality, in their, how they're formulated. The ideas themselves are very rich, and as I said, they're really paradigms of a kind of spiritual sophistication, a focus on authenticity and inwardness, and this radical critique of superficiality. But just let's begin with Alei Shur, which is his magnum opus. Alei Shur, of course, is an allusion to the Birchas Yaakov, the blessings of Yaakov for Yosef. And Yosef, while Yosef is this great cosmopolitan figure, right? Yosef goes down to Mitzrayim and represents the children of Yaakov in the great metropolis of the great civilization of Egypt. But Alei Shur, as the bracha of Yaakov says, what is the bracha? If you look, according to Chazal, Ben Parat Yosef, Ben Parat Alei Ayin, that Yosef is a fruitful vine, a fruitful vine by the fountain. Benos Tzada Alei Shur. This is in Bereishis Memtes Chaf Beis, that the branches of Yosef are over Alei Shur, on Shur, Alei Shur. What is Alei Shur? Open up. You see the little epigram that the book begins with. Ben Parat Yosef, Ben Parat Alei Ayin, Benot Saada Alei Shur, Alei Shur, Al Hachoma. What does Shur mean? What is Alei Shur? On the wall. Well, what a wonderful metaphor for what Rav Volbe is engaged in. Because what is the purpose of the Alei Shur? He says it on the title page. If you look quickly back to the front page, Alei Shur, Sharei HaHadracha, these are the gates of guidance. Nisayon lahadrich et ben dorenu b'knisaso l'toch olam haTorah uveshalvei aliyato. That this is an attempt. When we say in English the verb to essay, an essay is a document. It's a maimar. It's a written piece of work. To essay something is to attempt something, to try something. Nisayon is an attempt. It's an essay at what? To guide the children of our generation as they enter the world of Torah and in the levels of their elevation, the levels of their spiritual ascent. So who's his audience? Who's the audience of Alei Shur? Very clearly. Students. B'nai Torah. B'nai Yeshiva. And that's what Alei Shur means. The choma, the wall. The wall that separates the world of the yeshivas from outside. This is a kind of a provocative title and claim that there's a gap, there's a fundamental gap between the average person, even the Shomer Torah Mitzvos, and the Ben Yeshiva. Now this was very common in the motifs and the thematics of the world of the Yeshiva, or especially in the world of the Musar Yeshiva, where you were trained to be of a certain kind of character, a certain kind of spiritual superiority even. And that you saw the difference between the Ben Yeshiva and the other. But look how he flips this. Instead of it being a source of spiritual arrogance and spiritual superiority for the Ben Yeshiva, look what Rav Volbe does by flipping it on its head. Let's look inside together. Mechitza ava mabdelas ben olam haTorah leben haolam asher milchutz. There's a thick barrier, a thick partition that separates the the olam of Torah from the olam that is outside, from the world outside. Ha'omid b'chutz af imhu shomer Torah mitzvot. You could be standing on the outside, even if you're shomer Torah mitzvot. Ein lo tzir musag me'apela ha'mikholel b'fnim. You have no idea, you have no picture, you have no image or no concept of the wonderment that is taking place inside the world of the yeshiva. B'yesh, and here comes the flip. Asher gam ha'yoshev ben kotle beis ha'medrash, dome k'mishin ne'elmu minenu tamei Torah, the adayin mi'bechut omei. There are those that are in the yeshiva, they're physically in the yeshiva, they're sitting in the yeshiva, but they're really like those that are hidden from all the real understanding, all the tamim, the real reasons, the deep reasons of the Torah, and it's like they're still outside. Well, why? How is it that they've not penetrated the real world of the yeshiva? Kishelo shimesh tamidi chachamim. When they haven't sat at the foot of a Talmud Chacham and really understood his character. This is not about rote learning. This is not about even lumdus and refined, sophisticated Talmud learning. This is about character development. If you haven't been mishamesh a Talmud Chacham, you're outside of the olam of yeshivas, even though you're physically in the world of the yeshiva. But Dorenu, in our generation, Zeholchim Mizrabim Baruch Hashem Lomdei Torah. In our world, in our generation, thank God, their Torah is increasing. There are so many more B'nai Yeshiva today than ever was before in the history of the Jewish people. He's writing this in 1966. Okay? That's 51 years ago. It's even more true today. But he's saying there's a problem. Even though physically and quantitatively the Jewish student, the Talmud Chacham, the Ben Torah, is more numerous today than ever before, nevertheless, ach mu'atim heima hazochim l'shamish tamidei chachamim. But it's fewer than ever that are really that merit being with a true Talmud Chacham, that can see the true acts of a Talmud Chacham. Sfurim heim harabanim haromim l'malach Hashem tzvakos. But there are very few rabbis that achieve the level of Torah that you're gonna, like, they're like the angelic beings that from them you should seek Torah. Why? What happened historically just now within a generation? That all of these great Talmidei Chachamim that were worthy of emulation, of imitation, they die on the furnace. They die in the Shoah. And what? Barak Sridin Nishar Lufleta Asher Heim Bebechina Shiyara Knesset Agdola. What's left is only the few precious, few little embers that is like in the category of Shiyara Knesset Agdola, that the Pirkei Avos says that these are the remnants of the Knesset Agdola. That's what we've got left. We have very few great sages that can serve as models, as role models and character in emotional intelligence, in Torah values, not just in learning. Uvnei Torah asher badarenu ko hisraglu b'lima Torah b'lishi mushtam yichachamim. And the students in our generation, they're so used to studying Torah without the shimush of tam yichachamim. They don't even realize that they're outside of the world of Torah. They're not truly in the world of Torah. Even though they've acquired, they purchased, it's a kind of derogatory word almost, that they purchased a lot of Torah. They know a lot of Torah, they have a lot of yedios Torah, they have a lot of knowledge of Torah. But they don't have the real understanding of Torah character, of Torah personality. B'chutz heim omdim. They're still outside. They're standing outside of the olam yeshivas. Zot omeret, and here's the key line, shelo higiu l'pnimius ha-Torah u'l'pnimius atzmam. They have not reached the inwardness of the Torah or their own inwardness. They don't understand themselves. They don't understand who they are. They have no conception of what they're really about. What are their desires? What are their hopes and dreams? What are their weaknesses? What are their flaws? Who are they? And then I love what comes next. He gives this picture of sort of the ideal, what's perceived to be the ideal world of the yeshiva today, and then what's really going on. Mehem she'enem omdim klal al chaser lehem. There are those who don't even understand that they're missing something. They don't even, they think they're fine. They think they're great. They don't even understand that they're missing. They also have achieved great standing in Torah. They're supporting Torah. They're learning Torah. Echad nieh lamdan. One becomes a great Talmud Chacham, becomes a great lamdan. Hasheni nieh zahir ma'od b'dikduk ha-mitzvos. The second is meticulous in keeping all the mitzvos. He's a big machmir. He's very strict about the mitzvos. Shlishi, a third, Bochelios Askan Charedi. The third, he's not going to remain in Talmud Torah or learning or in the world of strict mitzvahs. He's going to be an Askan Charedi. He's going to be a Charedi public figure, a Charedi leader. Revi Nimshach Luknos. A fourth will go into zealotry and be against the Chiloni, against the religious Zionists. He'll be against, he'll be always against and against and against. Acherim margishim ki Torah's emes mehem bahala. Others who look at these four character types, these are great masters of Torah. These are the great leaders of our generation. Yikarim elim chapsim derech. But the precious ones are looking for a way. They're looking. They know that there's something missing. Heim koltim pikam peh hanagashon. They absorb the words from the mouths and the actions. And here's the devastating line. This is the killer. B'makom hachinuch b'hachikui. In the place of true chinuch, of true education, comes imitation. B'makom hashimush, and in the place of observing the greatness of another, of a Talmid Chacham, havana hashitchis mikli shlishi urvi. A superficial understanding that's third or fourth hand. This is a powerful critique of the Haredi world. And this can only be uttered by an insider. This kind of sharp critique, to have the kind of authenticity that it has, can only be authored and said by someone like a Rav Volbi, who's this great figure of the Musar world, of the Olam HaYeshivas, but a great observer of human nature, of human character, and sees the superficiality. That's the key takeaway in this passage in Ale. This is the Hakdama to Ale Shur. Is that we live in an age of religious superficiality. There's a lot of surface behavior, even a lot of surface learning, but very few have accessed the inner sanctum of the Torah. Yes, David.
Why do you say it's a critique of the only the Haredi?
Well, because he's writing for the we had meant he's the audience of this sefer is the Bnei Yeshiva of the Haredi world.
Well, wouldn't you say in truth it's a critique of our community?
Well, you stepped out for that part. I said that I want to recover. I think that Rav Volbi is a great figure because of his background, because of his perspicacity, his originality, his education. He can be reclaimed almost as a figure for the Orthodox enlightened community or the modern Orthodox community, as much as being a powerful figure for the Haredi community. Even though he himself, and that's we sort of saw in the title page what the purpose of the Alei Shur was. It was meant for the Bnei Yeshiva. It was meant for the Haredi community of Bnei Yeshiva. But you're absolutely right that the critique that he gives here can be applied equally to the modern Orthodox, in some ways even more, perhaps. You know, but it's a very powerful critique. And I think the fact that he's giving a critique to the people that pretend to be great gedolim and great lamdanim. That's what he says here. That these all are considered great leaders in the Olam HaHaredi today, in the Olam HaYeshivas today, but they're missing the real Torah of Bifnim, of the inwardness. Very, very powerful. Let's take a look at another representative passage in Rav Volbi. This time specifically putting the emphasis on individuality. You know, we just read in the Hakdam of the Alei Shur the contrast between real education and mere imitation. That's mechikui, b'makom mechinuch, yesh chikui. There's only imitation. So what's the remedy to that? How do you actually address that issue? Well, you focus on the legitimate individuality of each child, and each moment, each experience in life is radically individual, radically new, radically unique. And in a very powerful way, Rav Volbi conveys this sense of individuality and uniqueness, this time in the context of tefillah, in the context of davening. Yes, Cheryl.
Isn't individuality, contrary to imitation?
That's what he's saying, that imitation is the problem. He's critiquing imitation.
Oh, he's saying...
Shemush is not imitation. Shemush
would be, you're standing by it,
it's not imitation. It's more refined than that. There is a dialogue. There is a give and take in true shemush. He's the object of Rabobi's critique is chikwe, is imitation. He contrasts chinuch as opposed to shemush and chinuch. Chinuch and shemush are what we need. Chikwe is the superficiality of the modern yeshiva world. And he does this in a beautiful passage on tefillah. Let's take a look. On the second page here, B'Shabbos Kuf Chav Zayin Amud Beis Nechval Iyun Tefila B'Gemilas Chasadim. That the Gemara in Shabbos counts Iyun Tefila, a depth in davening, with Gemilas Chasadim, with a kind of mercy, a kind of kindness, a loving kindness. The Iyun Tefila B'Chlal Gemach Gemilas Chasadim B'Chsiv Gomel Nafsho Ish Chesed V'Nefesh Haynu Tefila. That Nefesh is an allusion to Tefila. Because by Chana, the mother of Shmuel, says that Eshpoch es nafshi lifnei Hashem, and nafshi there was her soul, was her inner communication, her dialogue with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, tefillah. Davar zeh yachol kol echad lahargish v'atzmo. And look, this is now a pedagogic. Not only are we talking about a concept that conveys a kind of pedagogical focus or an educational focus, namely inwardness and individuality, these are all critical elements in the lexicon of an educator. How do you treat chanoch lenar al pi darko? The klal gadol in chinuch, to educate each child according to their need, according to their derech. But now we're going to see how Ravobi uses a tool, a technique, that is very pedagogically sophisticated to convey an idea that also has a kind of pedagogic power. And what's the technique? He begins by saying, "Davar zeh yochol kol echad lahargish v'atzmo." You don't need to be a Talmid Chacham to understand what I'm about to say. You don't need to. Every human being can feel this for himself. What is it that? What is it? Rov hispatchuso shel ha'adam beruchnius k'shur b'tefila. Says that the majority of our development, our opening, and our development and advance in the world of ruchnius and spirituality is tied to tefila. That tefila becomes like a barometer, like a litmus test, a bellwether for our spiritual life in general. And this is true. I think we all feel this. This is what he said. Everybody feels this. When tefillah is not going well, we feel a certain kind of distance. When tefillah is going well, we feel a certain kind of connection. This is very intuitive. And then he gives some examples. Misha eino misfalo tefillaso kechov shigarti, that someone who doesn't daven in a way that's just a verbal obligation, meaning he's just going to potter it up, that except we daven it up. If someone doesn't daven that way, Ella, what? But how does he daven? How does he or she daven? Ella, who chai the tefillah, so they live through their tefillah. Yimsa kol tefillos of kshura zubazu. We find that every davening is somehow connected to another. What does that mean? The mincha hu maskil b'makom ha'pnimi b'nafsho bo gamar b'shachris. That at mincha he picks up the theme where his inner soul, his inner personality had finished in chakras. In other words, in chakras he was focusing on one element of his growth, of his spiritual life, his relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. At mincha, he picks it up and he moves it forward in a different direction, but continuing the theme. V'mayriv, hu mamshich v'makom shenisha b'mincha. And at mayriv, he picks up what he left at mincha. Amisfalo, the tam, the das, yochel lahayit da'atzmo. Someone who davens with tam and das, with das is a critical term in the Musar vocabulary. Especially Ravobi has a whole sefer called Kinyan Das. It's about the acquisition of this understanding. When you understand and you have a sense of the inner meaning of tefillah, you know kilo hirgish miyam of oser hargasha but oser tam b'shnei tefillos. We never feel the same feeling twice in two separate tefillah. In other words, they're connected, but each tefillah is radically unique. Each time we daven, it's an unduplicable experience. It never repeats itself. This is very powerful. This is a very powerful insight. And that when he gives it, now he's going to give his example. And he says, it's impossible. It's just logically impossible. That any two davenings would be qualitatively similar or exactly the same. Even though it has the same verbiage, it has the same liturgy, the same words. And now he gives a mashal. And here, this is what I meant by the tool, the pedagogic tool. Listen to this wonderful example that he uses to try to drive home this point about tefillah. Mashal, l'noseya v'rakeves m'istakel b'nof. Think about someone traveling on a rail car. Remember, he grew up in Germany and Switzerland. So he's in a rail car, he's looking at the landscape, he's looking at the view. Even though the view is physically the same, it's the same landscape, not one moment will be the same as the next moment. Your perception of this landscape will be constantly changing. It's the same objective reality of the field of view, it's the same landscape, but your inner life, your inner dialogue or inner monologue is completely new, completely unique every time you look at that landscape. That from every moment you're looking at this landscape from a different vantage point, from a new vantage point. Kain b'tfila, ha'adam noseahu halach v'nasua kol yemei chayav. That man, he travels, he grows, he develops, he's picked up by life, he leads life. The af rega eno roa es ha'olam me'osa nekuda pnimis ba'amad. Ahmad Kodain, that he does not ever look, not one second, at his inner life in the same way as he did previously. That we feel this sense of the uniqueness of every moment, of the unrepeatability of every spirit, of every single second in one's life and one's inner dialogue. We feel this most prominently in tefillah. It's in every realm of our spiritual life, but in davening, and with davening, we feel it most acutely, most powerfully. And look how he conveys this idea about uniqueness and individuality with a powerful pedagogic tool of this metaphor, this great image of you sitting on a railway and seeing the landscape in a radically different way every time you look at it, which is true to life, but it's meant to convey this profound truth about our spiritual lives.
Nonetheless, I find his metaphor strange.
How come?
Because his very point is that we should be mindful during tefillah. And yet he compares it to going on a train where we're not doing anything, we're just sitting.
But you're looking, if the truly mindful person, which is what he's trying to cultivate in every aspect of one's life, is mindful of that scenery, of that landscape. One never wants to be passive. For Ravolbi, one never wants to be just a passive sort of recipient of data, of sense data on the brain. He has this view of the mind as this active, very dynamic entity that is interacting with the objective world outside.
I'll sharpen it a bit. I thought what he was trying to say is that to say that one mincha is like yesterday's mincha is to say that nothing changed in you from the day before to now. You're not mindful at all.
I think he's saying that. I think he's trying to say that by definition, man is always dynamically engaged with his outer life and his inner life.
Right. So if you're really engaged, then ashrei can't mean the same thing exactly to you.
That's what he said. That's exactly what he said.
But I'm active. I'm not just sitting in a train and looking at the scenery.
Well, obviously davening is a more active activity. It's a more active type of practice than sitting on a train. But sitting on a train, if you take seriously your ability to be a dynamic creature and be an individual that is always growing and always learning, always being challenged, so then you're not going to be passive even in a circumstance that is on the surface more passive. But the point is, I think he starts with a metaphor that you'll understand from your own experience to then try to apply it to a more sophisticated, the application is not exact, it's not a perfect analogy. He's not suggesting that it's a perfect analogy.
He said driving a car. Somehow that was more active, more of an activity. But I'm quibbling. I don't want to press the point.
Okay. Okay. I want to now quickly go to the last piece here, Purim and Pesach, because I want to show you another instance of Rav Volbe's technique, if you will, his application of a rich concept, a rich theological or personalistic concept, but using, deploying a device which is very pedagogically sophisticated. Basically, this piece of Purim and Pesach makes the claim that, and he's writing this between Pesach and Purim. It's between, you go look at the date here, it's Yud Beis Adar Beis, from the Mir. There's a tradition that Purim, the Geula of Purim and the Geula of Pesach have some type of relationship. And he's trying to now unpack what's the precise nature of this relationship. So he basically cites a Gemara that's well known. The Rambam cites this in Hilchas Malachim, that the world to come, ein bo achila, lo shesia, lo piria derivia, lo masa matan, that the world to come is purely ethereal, purely spiritual, purely intellectual. There's no physicality, there's no dimension of the quantitative world. But what is it? It's tzadikim yoshvim v'idrosein v'roshein. It's the righteous with their heads crowned by the crown of Torah. V'nenim v'ziv ha'shchina. And they're enjoying the beauty of the Shechina, the rays of the Shechina, so to speak. This is a pasuk in Mishpatim, at the end of Mishpatim, talking about Maimon Har Sinai, that at Maimon Har Sinai, the children of Israel, Moshe and the Zakenim, saw an image of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Whatever that means for the theological challenges of anthropomorphism and corporeality, that's not what Rav Volbe is interested in. He's interested in the relationship between Torah and the world. So what does he say? Look at the underline. Harei tzir ha'yichidi sheyesh lanu me'olam haba hu matan Torah. That the sole depiction, the sole visual element, the sole way in which olam haba is described is borrowed from matan Torah. So that there's some kind of relationship here between matan Torah and olam haba. V'nilmad mikan shebeshas matan Torah. That somehow this experience of Maimon Har Sinai broke the barrier between this world and the ultimate world, and it was as if God elevates and brings Yisrael into Olam Haba, whatever that means. And he goes on to cite the well-known Gemara in Shabbos that Kadosh Baruch lifts up a mountain Har Kegigis and seemingly takes away our freedom, right? Freedom when you are threatened, when you see the supernatural, when you see nisim nigloim, your freedom, your will is really suspended because you no longer have a choice if you're seeing the reality of the divine or the reality of the supernatural. You're no longer in this physical world where your will can decide, do I want to believe in God? Do I not want to believe in God? This now becomes a mathematical or a physical certainty. So your Bechira is suspended. And we know, though, in the time of Purim, right? The Gemara says that in the time of Purim, they re-accepted the Torah, but this time not under the conditions of coercion, but under the free will. Because were there Nisim and Nigloim in the times of Purim? Absolutely not. Purim classically is known as the time of Nes Nistar. It's hidden. It's purely political, as we've discussed before. There was no miraculous supernatural intervention. So Purim becomes the remedy, so to speak, for the coercion of Maimon Har Sinai. Okay. Now comes the key. And this is, I think, this is the quote. Okay. How do we understand this? So look on page Reish Nun Aleph, the top of Reish Nun Aleph, Rav Volbi draws another metaphor. Anshei Sheirut Bitachon Habayim LeMedina Zara LeVarer Es Inyanim Sodiim Hanogim LeMedinasam Einem Yecholim LeDavach LeSholcheim Es Mashem Matzu Bikmichtav Ragil. When the defense forces arrive in a land, in a foreign land, and they want to clarify what are the true, the secret dealings in this country, they can't communicate with their agents in a traditional, in an obvious way, right? What do? What do? They use what's called invisible ink. They don't write with regular, ink. They write with invisible ink. They write on top of the invisible ink. They have what? Regular ink, and then it becomes what? A solvent. Then they send the letter to their agent, to their colleagues. And the agent has a machshir. They have a solution that they can then read the invisible ink. According to Rav Volbi, Yitzias Mitzrayim is the solvent. Yitzias Mitzrayim is the reality of God breaking the laws of nature and so clearly demonstrating his power over the physical universe that becomes embedded in the mindset, in the psyche of the Jewish people for all of eternity. That becomes the solvent for the hidden, the invisible ink of Purim. Purim is the Nes Nistar. Purim was something that you couldn't see, you couldn't really detect by traditional, normal, empirical means. But the memory of Yitzias Mitzrayim and the reality of God's Hashkacha, of Nes Nigla, becomes the invisible ink solvent that then helps the Jews in the later generation read the signs of the times of Esther. And he had a beautiful interpretation that it was the Ava of the Nes that gave that's why Jews accepted the Torah in the time of Megillas Esther. It wasn't the Ava of the Nes. That's the effect, not the cause. The Ava of the Nes was the Nes of Mitzrayim. That becomes the solvent that is the key to read the invisible ink of the Nes Nisr of Purim. That's an amazing metaphor that Rav Volbi uses as an educational tool, as a pedagogic tool, to teach a deep theological truth. Chag Kosher v'Sameach.
Thank you. Thank you. Start.